crucial and interesting progression in John 15, verse 16. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. Now, at first glance, the ultra-Calvinist or the hyper-Calvinist, by the way, I thought John Rice coined that term, hyper-Calvinist. He's always preaching us the hyper-Calvinist. That's the people that believe in predestination so much that man has very little, if anything, to do with it. They believe that Christ didn't die for the whole world, just died for the elect, just those that got saved. And Dr. Rice calls them hyper-Calvinists. He's been chasing hyper-Calvinists all his life. I thought that was his term. The other day I was reading a sermon by Spurgeon, and he started taking off on the hyper-Calvinist, and most people think Spurgeon was a hyper-Calvinist. And he started taking off and used the term hyper-Calvinist, and I thought to myself, well, there's nothing new under the sun. In fact, it was Spurgeon himself one time who preached a sermon, and folks gathered around him and said, that's one of the greatest sermons ever preached. That ought to be in print. He said, it is in print. That's where I got it. And I guess there's nothing new under the sun. But at first glance, when it says, you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, that seems to teach that we had nothing to do with being saved. God chose us, and we didn't choose him. But that's not what it says. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, and ordained you that ye should be saved. No, not talking about being saved, talking about fruit bearing. I have chosen you and ordained you that ye should go and bring forth fruit. In other words, you ought to be soul winners. This is not talking about God choosing folks to salvation. It's talking about God choosing folks to bring forth fruit. Now notice, and that your fruit should remain. Not just winning souls, but have them stick. Not just getting people saved, but having them remain. I don't mean remain saved, but I mean remain in service for Christ. That your fruit should remain. That whatsoever ye shall ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. How do you get your prayers answered? You go bring forth fruit, and you see to it your fruit sticks. Then what? Then you get your prayers answered. A lot of folks don't get their prayers answered because they're not soul winners. And because if they are soul winners, they don't work to keep the people saved in service for God. So first, you go and bring forth fruit. Number two, you see to it your fruit sticks. Number three, then you can ask what you want to, and God will give it to you. Now, how could God give such a blank check as that? How could God say to people, if you'll just bring forth fruit, and your fruit should remain, then ask anything you want, and I'll give it to you? How could God get by with that? Easy. Because a person that brings forth fruit, and his fruit remains, he gets wrapped up in the Lord. He asks what the Lord wants you to have anyway. Is that what you mean? What do you mean? Actually, you get your water changed. So God says, I can trust that fella. I can give him anything he wants because he's in my business. He and I are doing the same thing. He and I want the same results. He and I are heading in the same direction. So I can say to that fella, you ask what you want because I know he'll want right. You see? And it shall be given. Now notice this. These things I command you that you love one another. Now, it doesn't mean that he's commanding you to love one another. That's only one thing. He said, these things I command you. The better way to paraphrase it would be, these things I command you in order that you might love one another. How does a church love each other? People come to our church often and say, well, the house, I never have seen so much love. In fact, out in the, where I was this week, some preachers, theologians, were gathered around the table, and they were being a little critical of me and my ministry and the church here. They were saying, we understand it's a bit shallow and so forth. I said, okay, if you think it's shallow, I'll let my people take a Bible test. Your people take a Bible test. Let's publish the results and see who knows the Bible best, my people or yours. And so one fellow stood up and he said, I'd like to say a word. I've been to that church, and I know. He said, the truth is, Howell's people know more Bible than any church I've ever been in. Now, he said it doesn't hurt while they take it. I often say we put the orange juice in the castor oil here so it won't hurt while it's going down, so it'll taste good. But he said there's one thing about it. When you walk out of that church, there's two things you'll feel. The first thing you will feel like you've been to church. He said any time you go to First Baptist Church Hammond, when you leave, you'll feel like you've been to church. And he said in the second place, when you leave, you'll feel like the preacher loves the people and the people love the preacher and the people love each other. Now, how do you get people to love each other? You say, okay, I'm going to work on my folks loving each other. No. Like one time I was preaching in Texas, and a fellow came down this aisle and said, I want to love more. Wasn't long till his fiance came down the aisle and said, I want to love more. And I thought that was very unusual. But anyway, how do you get folks to love more? You say, okay, I'm going to preach some more. Love each other. These commercials, these idiots that put these commercials on, trying to talk folks into loving. have a bunch of famous people, you know, and they're chanting and singing some song or some wild song, and here's Bob Cousy here and Red Auerbach here and Sammy Davis Jr. here and shows this one here, and they're all chanting something and love, 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 love. Bunch of morons don't know the way home from school. You don't get love that way. You don't get love looking for love. You can't regiment folks into loving. There's a way you can love. How can you love each other? Go and bring forth fruit. Have your fruit remain. Ask what you will, and it will be given unto you. And God says, these things have I written unto you so you can love each other. That's the way you love each other. You get busy doing the will of God, and suddenly you love. Love is a byproduct. Love is no end. Love is a means. Love is a method. Love is no job to finish. Love is a tool. Love is the wrench. Love is a screwdriver. Love's not the engine. Love is the wrench that fixes the engine. It's a byproduct. You don't work on love. You work on the engine, and love comes because you want to get the engine fixed, you see. You'll spend your life trying to get people fixed, and you'll love people. And that's the result. That's the progression here. Now that the Bible study is over, now I want to give the sermon. We have none to lose. We have none to lose. Now, the text is in verse 16, and that your fruit should remain. Jesus said one time that of all the Father hath given me, I should lose none. Of all the Father hath given me, I should lose none. Give me just a trifle more trouble, fellas, would you? Now then, he said, he's interested in not losing people. You know, when our young folks here get married, and a couple that sang a while ago grew up in our church, and I got in on the, I was here while they were still single, and when we pray for them, and work with them, and plead with them, and counsel with them, and scold them, and do our best, the best we can, to make something of our kids, and then suddenly I'm at the altar here, and here's one of our fine young men, and down the aisle comes one of our fine young ladies, I just feel like saying, praise the Lord, this is graduation day. I mean, we didn't lose them. We didn't lose them. Ray and Mabel were saying, we didn't lose them. We kept them. They grew up here, but we didn't lose them. Now, there's a way you don't lose people, and we have none to lose. When our boys go off to college and become preachers, when our girls go off to school to become lovely Christians and a good Christian college somewhere, and I feel like we're over the hump. You know what I mean? You feel like you're over the hump, Brother Hand used to say. I think Mike has got it made now. If we can just keep him out of the penitentiary one more year. That's sort of the way it is. But there's that time when you feel like you sort of got it made. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to be perfect. It doesn't mean that there are no temptations left. It doesn't mean that it's completely 100% sure they're going to turn out okay. But they get to the place where you sort of say, well, I just believe they're going to make it. They remain. We don't lose them. They make it through the tough ages. I've told you this before. This is the thing that I told this week. I think that caused more laughter than anything else. Mark Twain said, when a child you know is 13, put him in a box. Lock him up in the box. Just don't let him out. Make him stay in the box all the time. Make the box about that big. And just saw a hole in the box about that big around so he can get enough air to breathe. When he gets 17, plug up the hole, he said. Plug up the hole. Now, that's not the answer. That's not the answer, though it is very tempting sometimes, kids. It is not the answer. But on the other hand, we have other young people that come to the same Sunday school classes, sit in the same pews, hear the same preacher, and yet they go off. We have young people, we have young folks who've been in this church and who sat here right beside you kids, heard the same preacher, heard the same songs, sit in the same Sunday school classes, grew up in the same church, and yet they're now hippies. Yeah. I know some of our kids, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night kids, and now they're on dope. How'd we lose them? I know kids that have been grown up in this church who don't even believe anymore in the virgin birth of Christ. How'd we lose them? Now let me say this. We lose them. We do lose some, but we have none to lose. And we ought not to ever be satisfied if we lose one. Jesus said, of all the Father give me, I should lose none, not one. He could have said, but take that shepherd. He had 100 sheep, and one of his sheep got lost, went away from the fold. The shepherd could have said, boy, I still got 99. No other church has that. We have 99% attendance. Boy, that's something. We ought to write the soul of the Lord and tell them to publish an article. We have 99% attendance. No, he wasn't satisfied. That didn't say he had 99 sheep and 100 sheep and 99 left. He had 99 who stayed and one left. But he said, I don't want to lose any. I don't have any to lose. And so the Lord does not want us to lose them. Now, listen carefully, and I'll show you how we can keep from losing them. I'll give you a plan this morning where you will not lose your child. I'll give you a plan this morning where your child will not be lost, and our children will not be lost. Now, follow me carefully. These boys in the front row, for example, these children, these little ones over in our junior churches and primary churches and beginner churches now, we don't have to lose them. We don't have to lose them. Now, when a baby is born, as you know, at birth, that baby is connected to his mother by a cord. When life is conceived in the womb, the unborn baby is completely dependent upon his mother. The baby does not eat for himself. He is nourished by his mother eating. The baby does not care for himself at all. His mother nourishes and feeds and cares for him. Now, when that baby is born and that cord is cut, there is a severance begun that ends at marriage. And that severance is a gradual one. It is not immediate. It is begun. For example, before birth, the mother feeds the child by feeding herself. Now then, if the baby is fed, breastfed, then the baby is fed from the mother. You see, not through the mother, but from the mother. Already, there's that severance begun. Now, the next step is the mother feeds the baby from something outside source, you see. In other words, first the mother feeds the baby by feeding herself. Then the mother feeds the baby from herself. Then the mother feeds the baby by herself. Notice that severance until finally the baby reaches down one day, grabs a bunch of food, and aims at the mouth. Now, he is continuing that severance. Now then, David's almost 17. I haven't fed David pablum in 6 months. I mean, David can almost feed himself now without any help at all. He can almost cut up his own meat. Now, what happened? There was a day when David was fed by his mother. Then there was a day when fed from his mother. Then the day his mother fed him, you see. And there's that gradual severance all the time. The gradual severance until the child is married. Now, John Rice said this to me, and I think I mentioned this when Becky was married. John Rice said this to me, and it's tremendous advice. We were out in Twin Falls, Idaho, in a conference, and he had a daughter who lives. John Rice has a daughter who lives in every town in America. But he had a daughter who lived in Twin Falls, Idaho. We were there in a conference in Boise in Twin Falls. We had two conferences going on at the same time, one at Boise, one at Twin Falls, and John Rice, Bill Rice, and I some would be in Boise one night, and one of us would be in Twin Falls, and a doctor would fly us between places every day. As we left to come home, Dr. Bill Rice and I were in Boise the last night. We flew commercially to Twin Falls. Dr. John Rice met us there, and we were looking out the window, and he was saying goodbye to Grace, his oldest daughter. So they kissed goodbye, and Dr. Rice turned abruptly and walked to the airplane, didn't shed a tear, didn't cry one tear. And I said to Dr. Bill, I don't see how he does it. I just don't see how he does it. Dr. Rice got on the plane, waved at Grace, opened a book, started reading. I said, Dr. Rice, how could you do that? He said, what? I said, how could you just, way out here in Idaho, your daughter lives, you haven't seen her for a year, you won't see her for another year probably, and you leave and don't shed a tear. He closed his book, put his glasses, I don't have my glasses with me, put his glasses in his mouth, you know, like we all do, either that or that. And he said, Dr. Hiles, he said, when that little baby was born 49 years ago, he said, I put that little bundle of flesh in my arms and looked at that little black hair and started preparing myself for today. I knew I'd have to give her up. I knew the day would come when I'd have to say goodbye to her. And in order to be able to do it without hurting myself and hurting her, I began preparing myself for today. That's a good idea. I learned something. It helped me tremendously. It's a good idea. Now then, as this severance begins, first it's just a bit. A baby just doesn't feed from his mother's body. A baby is not fed from his mother's breast. And then later a baby is not even fed from his mother's hands. But still his life is built around the home. First the baby leaves the mother's body. Then the baby leaves the mother's tender care. Then the baby leaves the mother's room to sleep in his own room. Then the baby leaves the mother's presence to go to school. Then the baby, again and again, gets bigger and bigger. And as he gets bigger, he's being severed and separated more and more. And it's God's plan. Now, don't fight against it. It's not much fun for the parent, but don't fight against it. That's why a lot of times boys and girls don't leave mothers, because keeping mother's apron strings. And a child gets, I know grown men that are as tied to their mother as they were when they were little boys. I'll ask mother if I can go. And tied to mother's apron strings and never grow up, never make decisions on their own. And so what I'm saying is this, that natural, don't fight it, but prepare for it. Now listen, that's what I want to talk about this morning. Prepare for it. Remember when you first went off to college, or went off to the service, and how hard it was to leave home? I'll never forget. I'll never forget when I went off to college. I was an usher in my church. And that last trip down the aisle that Sunday morning, I thought I would die. I'd take an offering. By the way, you won't believe this, but I also sang in the choir. I sang bass in the choir. Yeah, big choir too. You say, how'd you do it? I got beside Proctor Boyd. He was the best bass in the choir. And I sat beside him, and I just try to hit the note he hit. I'd stay just a little bit behind him and say, I am resolved. I'd see him say, I, and I'd say, I am, Ray, resolve, you know. But that last morning, I came down the aisle with the plate under my arm, and I said, this is it. I'm going off to college. I'll never do this again. I'll leave my home church for good. I'll never, never come back to live here again. And my heart was crushed. So, came back the first time for a visit. Boy, I was glad to get home. I want to see the old place. But you know, I didn't feel at home. I didn't feel at home. And I do not think I've ever had an impure feeling in my life than that first visit. Kids, you're going to face it as sure as I'm standing here. The first visit you come home from college, you're going to think you're going to feel at home, and you're going to feel out of socket. Oh, it's going to be good to be home. You're going to be glad to see your your pastor again. But you're going to be glad to see mom and dad and the church and the friends and so forth. But it's not going to be the same. What's happened? You've grown up. The severance is finished now. You'll never feel at home again. You'll feel like your home church. And then the summertime will come, and you can't wait to get home. But do you know before you know it? You want to go back to school? What's happening? You have gone through the natural God-given plan of pulling away. God made it that way. That's why he said a man shall leave his mother and leave his father and cleave to his own wife, you see. Because the natural thing is taking place. Now, there are two ways. Parents, listen. There are two things you can do about this. One thing you do is lament it. Now, here's what the average parent does. Child gets about 13, and the parent says, you just don't appreciate your daddy anymore. You just get in the place you just not thoughtful. And you're getting the place where you haven't got any sense. Now, that's natural. Don't misunderstand me. You ought to appreciate your parents. And I spend a lot of time telling you that you should appreciate them. But the truth is, you want to keep them tied. You say, your mothers say to your sons, son, listen now. Your mother said to your son, I have worked for you, worked my hands to the bone. And there you go off with some little old gal you haven't known for 2 weeks and spend all your time with her and never spend any time with mother. You just don't appreciate your mother anymore. Don't know what this younger generation's coming to. It's coming to where the old generation's been. It's where it's coming to. Now, I've been through the same thing. I can recall when I'd come home, my kids were little, I can recall when I'd come home from a trip, brother, they'd kill a fatted calf, they'd drop everything, and now they don't even know I've been gone. I come in and say, I'm home. They say, did you leave? Now you can lament it. and you can throw up your hands, blame the kids, or you can do this as they leave. I want to use this mic too, fellas, this morning. As the children leave you, you can. You can run over here and catch them as they leave. Now, there's two things you can do. You can either say, you don't appreciate me anymore, or you can not let them know you're going to catch them. But as they go away a little bit, get over here and meet them. And as they go away a little bit more, get over here and meet them. And as they go away some more, get over and meet them. Now, how do you do it? One thing you do is you don't tell them what you're doing. You don't tell them what you're doing. So, children, stop your ears for a minute, would you please? You see, the trouble is, the young people want to fight it. Young people come to me all often and say, my mother just doesn't understand me. My father just doesn't understand me. I don't tell them, but I don't understand them either. But now, of course, there never has been a parent that understood a teenager. Never has been. When I got 13, my mother had a mental problem. Really. Now, mother's here this morning, and I hope she won't be offended, but she did. When I got 13, mother was having some serious emotional problems. When I got 15, I felt surely she'd have to spend the rest of her life in an institution. When I got 16 years of age, mother was about ready for Westfield. At the age of 17, I didn't want any of my friends to see her. When I got about 19, there was some noticeable recovery. At 20, she was getting at least where I could bring friends in again. And now at 44, mother is smarter than she's ever been in her life. Now, I was worried about her for a while. How many of you think my mother changed? No, she didn't change. I became a teenager, you see. But now, my mother was a genius. She knew what to do, and she did it, and she did it properly. In spite of the fact I didn't turn out too well, she did it properly. Now, what do you do? All right, here's what you do. You fill every void. Now, listen carefully. You fill every void that is made with the church. Now, look. It is natural for a child to pull away and spend time. Here's the home over here. Here's the home over here. Now then, hi Dad. Here's Dad. You see? Now here's the pastor of the church over here. Now, he and I, here's my boy. Come closer to me, Dad. Here's my father. And he and I have had a wonderful time together. We went fishing when I was a little boy. And so Dad asked me if I want to go fishing with you today.
You'd like to go fishing with me today, son?
Dad, I really would like to go, but I got... some kids are going to go out today and play ball. I really would like to go. Okay, now have a seat. Now, he can sit there and cry. He can lament. Well, my boy's gone. I tell you what he can do. He can go over here to the pastor and say, Pastor, could I work with the young people? Or, Pastor, I want to do my best, if I can, to fill the void with the church in the life of my boy. Are all the boys, you see. So, suppose that he's my dad, and I'm wrapped up in him 90% of the time, and 10% I spend away from the home. That's natural now. All right? Then when I get to where I spend 10% away from home, then what the church has got to do is fill up that 10%. And if you do that, you don't lose them. The home loses them, but the church doesn't lose them. Now, as I continue growing, getting older, then I spend 20% of my time away from my dad. Now, what can you do? He can say, I'm losing my boy. Yes, he is. And it's natural. There's no way to keep from it. No way in this world. Because God has made it where the outside world is more appealing than home. Because the boy's got to launch into the outside world. And God is preparing him for that. What's the dad going to do? The church has got to take 20% of the life now, so that the entire life is wrapped up between the home and the church. If the church can provide enough to fill that void. Here's a kid comes up. He's a junior. In fact, I have here about like I think. I think that a beginner child, for example, is 90% tied to his home. All right? Now, the other 10% he can have at school or at church. He goes to kindergarten, he can have it there. Or he can have outside little friends to play with out in the yard and so forth. All right? Or the church can say, we are going to take up the other 10. We're not going to lose that kid. Now, you don't lose the kid. Kid doesn't quit coming to church, but you lose his interest. And he is divorcing himself from the church. Now, look, the church should not be synonymous with the parent. The church should be supplement the parent. The church, if a child leaves home, he should not at the same time have to leave the church. You see, the church is the place to which he can go. It's the refuge to fill up that out-of-the-home life. When a child becomes a primary, I'd say he's 20% wrapped up in the outside and 80% with his parents. That means if you're a primary teacher, you ought to have more extracurricular activities than a beginner teacher. Sit up, boys. That means that a primary teacher, do you notice that? That's why I say that. I said, sit up, boys, and every kid along here, sit up. You see? I wish I could teach some college presidents that. But anyway, now, that means a primary teacher has to work harder. Why? Because the primary child is more gone from home than a beginner child is. All right? Now, I'd say that when a child becomes a junior, it's about 50-50. Remember when you used to say, you want a nickel? Oh, goody, 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 I get a nickel. Now try it. Now try it. It takes more. I could say to Becky when she was 4 or 5 years of age, Becky, you want to go to the store with Daddy? Oh, David, I'm going to the store with Daddy. I said 2 years ago, Becky, you want to go to the Holy Land, Rome, London, Paris, Cairo, Egypt, Athens, Jerusalem, Sea of Galilee, Calvary, Gethsemane, Bethlehem's manger. Want to go with Dad? No, I want to stay home with Tim. Can you feature that? I'd rather go anywhere with me than stay home with Tim. But she wants to stay home with Tim. Wasn't even married then either. What happened? You see, it takes more now. Now, when a child becomes a junior, then the child spends about 50-50. See, he's playing ball in the vacant lot. That means the church better have a ball game in the vacant lot. You see what I'm saying? Now he's beginning to notice little girls. Now, when he was a primary, he didn't even know there was a female gender. Now he's a junior. He begins to notice, but he doesn't want them to know he notices, and so he pulls their hair and shoots spitballs at them. Say, "Dad, girls." See, now then, if he's going to the girls, then you better have the right kind of girls for him to at. You see? Because he is more and more. He's half gone. Age-wise, he's half gone. He's 9 years old. He's 10 years old. He's half gone. He's over the hump. And so, because of that, in the progression from the being connected to his mother's body to the leaving of the home, the child is halfway in his progression. That means half his life is spent outside the home, and that means the church has to be ready to catch him and give him that half life so we'll not lose him. Now, if the church doesn't, he's gone. That's why you parents say sometimes, I ought to be a taxi driver. All I do is drive my kids to church. You better thank God for it. You better thank God for it. When Becky was going, before Becky left home, she never was in a car, with my permission, alone with a boy. Now, personally, I think that dates with boys and girls alone in cars are more dangerous than marijuana. Now, you not agree with me? Okay, but I tell you what, if you will, you'll be glad you did. But she never was. She double dated sometime with nice kids, but I always had to approve. But she never was. Now, what happened is this. Becky's life was disciplined and wrapped up in the church. And so, because of it, we did not lose Becky. Now, a child starts off looking toward the girls at junior age and so forth, and we fill that void. 50%, it must be filled with the church and with activities at the church. So important, so vital. All right, a child becomes a junior higher. I'd say it's 30 and 70 then. At junior high age, you notice it. You watch it. I tell you, if you haven't had a kid junior high age yet, you wait and see. You wait till you start to say, when they're 13, where do you want to go on vacation this year? And they'll say, I don't want much. Why don't we just stay at home this year? Huh? I see a lot of parents grinning all over the place. Huh? Why? Because they don't want to leave their world, 70% of their world, and go with you. You're okay to eat with. There's nobody else to eat with. And you're mighty nice to have around at dishwashing time. And at washing day and time to iron. You see? But now they don't want to go. Why? They're pulling away. Now then the child, 30% with his parents, 70% away. The church had better get ready and undergird and give that 70% or we'll lose them. That's why if you teach a junior high class, you've got to work seven times as hard as a beginner teacher. Why? If they're going to be, if they're going to go 70% of the time, we've got to have that 70% filled. This is the great philosophy, though many of you did not know it, this is the great philosophy behind the First Baptist Church of Hammond. Right here. Right here. That means that the high school, junior high teacher has to work harder than the junior teacher. Look, the great age of losing children is right in this age, 13 through high school graduation. Now why? Now follow me carefully, tell you why. Here is a child, beginner, and the beginner teacher does a good job, and the child is happy, and we don't lose the child. Here is a child because of primary, and the primary teacher does as good a job as the beginner teacher, and so we don't lose the child. Child becomes a junior, and the junior teacher does as good a job. I'm talking about extracurricular now. I know about planning the life outside the class and outside the home. The junior teacher, as good as the beginner teacher, provides the same thing. And we start losing. And here over here is a teenage child. And we lose. And he leaves the church. Why? I'll tell you why. Because the teenage teacher is doing exactly what the beginner teacher did. No better, no worse. But you've got to do better. Let me ask you a question. The child over here has 10% of his life he needs filled. And over here he has 90%. And that's what it is at the high school age. It's 90% at least. I recall that Becky used to go with Kenny Wright. And Paul Wright had to drive them everywhere they went because I was narrow-minded. God bless Paul Wright. That poor man, he spent more time at my house than I did. He'd come over and with Kenny to get Becky, and they'd go. Why? And now that David's old enough, I've changed my convictions about that. I don't want to do all that driving. No, I haven't either. But I'm saying this. I'm saying it's hard, but you've got to fit it, you see. Now, if this high school student that has 90% of his life outside of his family, if that high school student needing 90%, having a 90% void, only gets 45% void, he's going to get 45% out in the world. It's going to be filled. The child, it's natural. God planned it. It's going to be filled. He is going to fill his time, 90%. Now, the church either fills it or loses the child. Now, that's where they're lost. May I say this? Some of the finest Sunday school teachers in this church are going to have blood on their hands when they stand before the judgment seat of Christ. I mean, good teachers. Teach the Bible. Love the Lord. Except you are not providing enough for your class. And they have to have something. I believe this.
I believe when the church sees a certain age, a child comes to, the church sees that age and sees that void becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and the need of outside interest becoming bigger as God made it that way, bigger and bigger. I think the church has to say, okay, we'll make our program bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and we'll not lose our kids. We're going to keep them. We're going to sell ourselves, spend ourselves, do what we have to do, but we're not going to lose our kids. We don't have any kids to lose. You check sometimes the Sunday school attendance records. You check how many kids we have in the church 6 years of age, and you check how many we have 7 and 8 and 9 and 10. And you go back through the years and find out how many kids we had in a certain department. You take 5 years ago, the kids that are now seniors in high school, go check how many they ran. In every case, they're running less in attendance now by big percentage than the same group was when they were in the last year of elementary school. Why? Because they needed something we didn't give them. That's exactly why we lost them. It's our fault. Don't you say, he's just a bad kid. He's not a bad kid. He's like everybody else's kid. He had a void in his life, and we as God's people were too indifferent, too lazy, and too careless to fill that void. And the kid grew up, and he had to go somewhere. He had that natural severance from his parents. He had that void getting bigger and bigger, and we didn't do anything to fill that void, and now the kid's gone. We've lost him. Who did it? We did it. We did it. I don't care who you are. I don't care who you are. When a kid gets to becomes a teenager, he's going to have outside interest. It must be filled, and it will be filled. Now, how do we do it? One way we do it is through our high school. Our high school, if a child will go to our high school, David said something the other day to me, and I think I quoted him already. It was the most significant statement that he's ever made to me. It exactly illustrates my sermon. Now, David's almost 17. We're driving home together, as we always do on Sunday night, and Dave said, Dad, did you know that my entire life is filled with God's people? I said, what do you mean, Doc? He said, Dad, when I go to church on Sunday, but that's not all. He said, when I go to school on Monday, it's a Christian school. And on Monday night, I go practice music, it's a Christian choir. I only sing in Christian groups. I get educated at a Christian school. He said, Dad, when I have a day, it's always a youth activity at church. Now, I know what you're going to say, and that old song and dance has been trying to be propped up for years. Well, how are they going to face a wicked world if you keep them sheltered all the time? That's not even valid. Child is not supposed to face a wicked world, but he's strong enough to face a wicked world. I got drafted in World War II, and they put me in. I got in one day, and the next day they said, okay, we want you to go fight a few battles. Here's a gun. Where's the trigger? Well, no matter about that. Just if I find it. Which way do I point it? Well, just whichever way you think you ought to point it. After all, if you have to fight someday, you better start fighting now. No, sir. They kept me with older and more experienced men. And they trained me, I climbed walls, I went on obstacle courses, I crawled under barbed wire, I threw hand grenades, I shot bazookas, I shot mortars, I went on the rifle range, I walked 26 miles, I ran 10 miles a day, I jumped out of airplanes, went on maneuvers, I went on bivouac, I shot and I fought and I got a bayonet, stuck it into my rifle, and they said, long thrust, hoo! Short thrust, hoo! Long thrust, short thrust, and we practiced those things and put dummies up there. We didn't stick a German right away. We stuck some dummies first because the German sticks back. And we weren't ready yet to get stuck back. We had to stick somebody that couldn't stick back so we could learn how to stick. What were we doing? We were getting ready to fight. We weren't ready to fight yet. And a 17-year-old child is not ready to fight this whole world yet. He's still in training. He's still preparing. You give me a child that has been, call it sheltered if you want to call it sheltered. You give me a child that's been sheltered,
trained, taught, prepared. He knows the enemy, but he's not yet fought the enemy. Now, they showed us Germans fighting. They showed us atrocities. They showed us things that the Japanese were doing to our boys in concentration camps and stirred our blood to run bold, run hot, and to want to fight. By the time we got out of basic training, brother, if a fella had 1/10 German blood in him, we wanted to kill him. Every time I'd see a fella a little sleepy in the morning, I'd think he's a Japanese. I want to shoot him. Why? They taught us how to someday fight in the war, but we were not ready to fight in the war. And as these boys and girls grow up, a child that's 14 years of age is not prepared yet to read Catcher in the Rye or some dirty, filthy, vulgar sex book in high school. He's not ready. By the way, when a man's 40, he's not ready either for that. Child is not ready to have to be around dope when he's 13 and 14 years of age. The worst dope in the high school is these dopes that let it go on. Not ready yet. Oh, if we lose none, we have to catch them when they come from the mother's arms and say, we'll fill that void. We'll have a Thanksgiving party for the beginners, an Easter egg hunt. They don't need as much. We don't have an activity every week for the beginners in primaries. No. But when they become juniors, we have an activity every month. Why? Because the junior is not yet pulled away, but he's pulling away. When they become teenagers, it's every week we have something. Choir practice on one night, and group practice on one night, and youth activity on one night, and high school activity on one night. Why? As that child goes farther and farther and farther from mother, he must be caught with the church, or the world will catch him, and we'll lose him. That's why you have children in public school system. Don't you let them get in the drama club. You get them in the church choir. You be sure, ladies and gentlemen, that the activities that in which they participate, made void by their natural pulling away from home, you make sure that they do that with God's people. Now, that's the philosophy behind this church. If it's wrong, I doubt it, but if it's wrong, it is a sincere one. We want to take your child when he's born, and whatever time, whatever void is made there as he grows older, we as a church want to fill that void. That's why you Sunday school teachers ought to do your best. That's why our youth program ought to be second to none. That's why our youth singing groups ought to be the very best. Why? It's God's business. I said to one of our staff members this morning, talking about something that perhaps should have been done. And I said, it should have been done. And this staff member, a very fine member of our staff, and one of the most cordial members we have, and certainly he and I have no problems with each other. I'm just trying to train the staff to always do the thing as it ought to be done. And we're talking, and he said, well, how can I know whether I'll do it or not? And I said, check and see if the department stores do it. Check and see if the sharpest secular people do it. And if they do it, in matter of preparation for their services and their businesses, we ought to do it. No work ought to be run second. No, God's work ought never be run second to the world. Best organized thing in town ought to be the First Baptist Church Hammond. One of the biggest businessmen in this town, had a fellow, a business associate, come from New York City, and he was a Catholic. Both of them were Catholics, as I understand the story. The fellow said, I want to spend some time sightseeing. He said, what do you want to see? Well, he said, I want to see the things in Hammond that are most worth seeing. That afternoon, they drove down Sibley Street, and this Catholic fellow parked across the street from our church and said, there it is. He said, no, I don't mean that. He said, I want to see the thing that most of the tourists see when they come, the tourist attraction. He said, there it is. No, he said, I want the thing that attracts more outsiders than any other thing in Hammond. He said, there it is. He said, sir, I'm a Catholic, but that's the biggest thing in this town, that church. It ought to always be that way. It's God's business. If we would save our own and lose none, we have to go back to the beginner department when there's 10% and provide that 10.
and the primary and provide that 20, and the junior and provide that 50, and the junior high and provide that 70, and the high school and provide that 90. And if we do it, we'll lose none. We don't have to lose them. We must provide, and the parents must see to it they get here. I have no greater joy in the ministry than to see our kids turn out good, turn out right. No greater joy. I stay across this country often. I feel sorry for every preacher who's not a pastor. I wouldn't want to be an evangelist. I wouldn't want to be a missionary. I want to be a pastor. I've been here all, this is my 12th year. Do you realize that children that started the school the year I came are graduating this year? I've been here now long enough to turn out an entire generation from the day they started the school. David will be a senior next year. He started the kindergarten the first year he was in Hammond. Now, I want our kids to turn out right. I want us to have as many seniors in high school as we have in the junior department for the same grade. And I have no greater sorrow, none, than to see our kids not turn out right. Listen to me. Some of the kids in our church, I plead with you now. If we may not agree, but I plead with you because I know what I'm talking about. Trust me on this matter. We have some kids in our church, the best families we have. We just don't lose bus kids. We lose kids from the very best families in this church. I preached in a church last Tuesday night. Pastor has been to our pastor school. He opened a letter and said, my ministry has changed. My church has changed. Started off with a building not as big as this choir. Now he runs 500 and 600 in Sunday school, still growing. His church is transformed. Ministry is transformed. And he said, Dr. Hiles, you have done more for my ministry than all the other men in America put together. I want you to come to my home and meet my family. You would have thought that President Nixon walked in the door. Now, follow me. Little Frank, about 4 years old, came up and said, hello, Brother Hiles. Boy, eyes got big. He said, Daddy, is that the one? It's easy to get him. Little girl about 7 walked in, and I said, well, hello there. You're the prettiest one in the house. She said, thank you. She looked at me. Little boy about 12 walked in. He said, this is, called his name. I said, hi, fella. He said, hello. Dinner ready, Mom? 17-year-old boy walked in. Preacher's son. Preacher that came to our pastor school. Church been transformed. His hair was down to here. Yeah. Preacher's kid. Hair was down to here. I said, hi, son. Hi. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there was a day when that little fellow was 4. What happened to him? Even the preacher's kid pulled away from his dad. That fellow got to the pastor's school about 10 years too late. Now, we don't have to lose them. But if we keep them, we have to keep them on purpose. Strange sermon? It could well change your family's life. Strange, unusual sermon, it could well determine the future of thousands of people. If every choir director in this church will say, we'll fill that void. If every youth worker will say, we'll fill that void. If every teenage worker will say, we'll fill that void. If our high school faculty and teachers and administration and workers will say, we'll fill that void. If I as pastor and we as staff and deacons and people will say, we'll not lose them. We'll keep them. We'll work ourselves to the bone to keep them. We won't lose them if we won't. There's a way to keep them, but it's on purpose. Now this morning, if you're here and have no church home, or a church home that is not trying to do what I'm talking about this morning for the sake of your family, get in one. If you're here this morning and have not been baptized, then you obey Christ in baptism. And certainly if you're here and not saved, you ought to begin the Christian life by trusting Jesus Christ as Savior. Let us bow our heads for prayer, please.